Hey, I'm Johanna Wagstaff.
And hi there, I'm Rohith Joseph.
And we're asking for 10 minutes of your day to go through the 10 things that the UN recommends we can all do when it comes to climate change.
Please don't leave.
No.
And also, the things aren't new.
We are just wired to not do them.
We promise you to help you figure out your brains, and you and your people can make better choices to combat climate change.
10 Minutes to Save the Planet is available now on CBC Listen and everywhere you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the podcast edition. Tonight.
Dangerous ground. After entering Sudan for the first time since war broke out last year, an aid worker tells us children are the conflict's most heartbreaking victims, whether they are suffering from the violence or the hunger it has imposed.
Putin on an act. Russia's election has only just begun, but plans for Vladimir Putin's victory celebrations are already underway. An observer says voters may be hoping for change, but they're not expecting it anytime soon.
Rite of passage. We'll speak with the head of the UN's humanitarian efforts in Gaza about a new land crossing to deliver aid and new threats of an Israeli military incursion into Rafah.
Unsolved and unresolved. A year after a deadly fire in Montreal, one father is still looking for answers about who set that fire and how to keep living after unimaginable loss.
Changing our tunes, fans of karaoke are singing the praises of the Japanese inventor whose machine first allowed all of us to belt out our favorite songs at ear-splitting volume.
And it is surprising that she could stand for that. But she did. And tonight, a zookeeper describes the birth of a rare species of giraffe after a 15-month-long pregnancy and a 6-foot fall to the ground. As it happens, the Friday edition, radio that supports a true mom and plop operation. Unless the world takes action, the UN is warning there could be a catastrophic loss of life in Sudan. The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, painted a bleak picture at a press conference today after its staff members finally re-entered Sudan last week. For almost a year now, the country has been locked in a civil war between the army and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. Thousands have died, and millions have had to flee their homes. Jill Lawler is the Chief of Field Operations and Emergency for UNICEF in Sudan.
Jill, we've spoken about the concerns about the potential for a famine in Sudan on this program before. Now that you've returned from this trip, you know, and in your briefing you said hunger is pervasive. It's the number one concern people expressed to you and your team. What did they tell you?
In the 3 days that we were in the Omdurman area, every single day we saw evidence of that struggle, from malnourished children to adults who are also equally malnourished. Interestingly, as we got deeper into the Omdurman area, there's food in the markets. Yeah. We saw meat hanging, tomatoes on the streets. And so when we heard from the doctors and the caregivers about increased malnutrition rates, and they spoke a lot about anemia as well, we asked, well, why is that? And they said it's because of the price of food, and being 11 months into a conflict that is shut down income opportunities for families. Mm-hmm. And so families are just really running out of resources to afford food, and inflation has increased in Khartoum and has increased everywhere in Sudan. Yeah. And so it's just becoming harder and harder for families.
How did what you saw in person, after being able to get in now, square with what you thought you would see and what you had heard?
You know, it did track with what we expected. More people on the streets in Karari, fewer and fewer as you got in. Two of the 3 days we were in the Omdurman area, artillery was firing. We could hear the loud thuds. And on the second day when we were approaching the Omdurman area, there's just this thick black cloud of smoke. So it's very much still an active conflict. And the people there in the area have grown quite used to the sounds of thuds and the artillery. It's a heavily armed area. So that was tracking with what we expected as well. We saw a lot of young people. I can't verify the ages, mm-hmm. but a lot of young people carrying weapons. A lot of weapons in the hospitals as well.
And in the middle of all of that, in the hospital, there are doctors, nurses, as you mentioned, trying to help people, children in particular. You spoke today about several stories that stay with you. What is one that you want to share with our audience to illustrate what you saw and what is happening?
There are a number of stories to share, but I think the two that really hit hard, just seeing patients who had recently had limbs amputated, young people who, before all of this, were able-bodied people and contributing, and just to see them on beds with missing limbs was really, really striking. And then the other story was just this young woman who had come from an area that was a little bit hard to access, and she found her way to this hospital. Her little baby is 3 months old, seeking treatment for diarrhea. And the cause was she had substituted goat milk for mm-hmm. a milk product because of the lack of income again. And you could see she was exhausted. She was concerned about her baby, and she's one of the lucky ones to be able to make it to a hospital. There are so many others that just haven't been able to make that trek for either access reasons, resource reasons, a number of reasons.
Something else that stood out to me in what you released today was that we are 11 months into this conflict. Mm. The people there are 11 months into this conflict, and young women and girls who had experienced sexual violence are carrying children from those assaults.
Yeah, that was hard to hear. And we've read reports, we've heard reports of this, but to be there and hearing direct reports by the doctors, specifically saying that these young women, often coming alone because of the stigma associated with it, coming, delivering, and many leaving their child at the hospital. I have personal experiences, people who are close to me who either made the decision to terminate or made the decision to carry through with the pregnancy to abandon the child.
We spoke to Jan Egeland from the Norwegian Refugee Council last month. He was in Chad speaking to refugees from this conflict. He had not been inside as you have, seeing people there up close and speaking with them. But he said at the time that we spoke that the world, it seems, had forgotten about this crisis and how much need there is. Do you feel that the world has forgotten?
I do, and I don't know what to do. Mm. You know, it's a conflict amidst so many conflicts and hardship across the world, which is just sad in itself. But Sudan is really suffering. The children of Sudan are suffering. They've been suffering, you know, far before this year, but this year alone, it's the world's largest displacement crisis, but you just wouldn't know it. And the malnutrition figures are scary. They should really be frightening and be something that the world talks about. The possibility of famine should be something that we should all be mobilizing and trying to do our level best to address.
And what specifically are you asking people around the world, governments around the world, to do?
We need highest level advocacy for a ceasefire. We need highest level advocacy for this war to stop, and for humanitarians to have sustainable access to the hardest to reach places. We need to be able to get our supplies in a timely way, free from bureaucratic impediments.
Jill, thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you for the time.
Jill Lawler is the Chief of Field Operations and Emergency for UNICEF in Sudan. We reached her today in New York. Thank you. Congratulations are in order tonight for Vladimir Putin, who has just been reelected president of Russia for the fifth time. Who will have just been reelected president 3 days from now. Russia's presidential election got underway earlier today. Voting across the country's 11 time zones is set to take 3 full days. But Mr. Putin will definitely win, which does not mean he has nothing at stake in this weekend's vote, not according to Leonid Rogozin. Mr. Rogozin is a freelance journalist who used to work for the BBC in Moscow. We reached him in Berlin.
Leonid, if Vladimir Putin's victory is essentially guaranteed in this election, what is at stake in this vote?
Well, it is guaranteed indeed, and everybody knows that Putin is going to win. However, the Kremlin traditionally puts a lot of effort into achieving this victory. Mm-hmm. And in this particular situation, it is crucially important for them to get more votes than at any other time. They want to get up to 80% of votes. And this is because the election is essentially a plebiscite, a referendum on the war in Ukraine. They need to show that a vast majority of Russians are supporting the war effort, that mm-hmm. the nation is behind the president. And it's a signal essentially to both Ukraine and the West that Russians are not going to be disunited, and they're not going to rise up against this policy, the policy of war essentially.
So it's for the domestic and international audience. What is the Kremlin doing to secure the kind of outcome and potentially a record turnout if they get their way in this election? What are they doing?
Well, it is a very interesting part of what the Kremlin is doing. Of course, the election is rigged, and of course, the pro-democracy and opposition candidates are barred from participating in it. However, the Kremlin puts a lot of effort in the work of spin doctors in the campaign, not dissimilar to what they do in the West. They actually work with the population in order to achieve a certain result. So there is both a rigging going on through early voting and through electronic voting. But at the same time, there is a campaign on all television channels, on all radio shows, and online, and that's aimed at achieving a result that is reflecting the actual mood in society.
Is it though? Can we be sure that it is reflecting the actual mood in society?
Well, it is a hard question to answer, because in authoritarian totalitarian society, one major phenomenon is preference falsification. So people are quite atomized. In Russia, people are quite extremely atomized. And in public, they behave the way other people behave. So for the state, for the Kremlin, it's very important to blow this bubble, to create the impression that society is supportive of the war effort, of other policies. But at the same time, this is achieved through very crude propaganda, and also through repression. I mean, ultimately, it is worth remembering that the main rival of Putin, Alexei Navalny, was mm-hmm. first poisoned, and then he spent almost 3 years in prison and eventually died in suspicious circumstances. And when it comes to more moderate opposition candidates, one of them was an anti-war candidate, was barred from this election. And there is an effort even to undermine the pseudo-liberal candidate who is officially participating.
Let's talk about Alexei Navalny. Before his death, he encouraged voters to go to the polls but to register a protest vote. Have you seen any evidence or heard any evidence of that happening?
Well, that's the traditional strategy employed by Navalny's foundation and his movement for many years. After Navalny's death, his widow, Yulia Navalny, she called on Russians to show up at polling stations exactly at midday on the day of election, just to create a crowd, so to say, to create a television picture at various polling stations around the country. Whether this is going to work or not, that's a big question. It sounds like a risk-free kind of protest, but we know that the authorities are using surveillance cameras to identify random protesters and then prosecute them. So risks are still involved. And also it is unclear what the outreach mm-hmm. of the opposition is now. But this decision was, I guess, inspired by the funeral of Navalny, which was attended by thousands and thousands of people.
We've mentioned that you're not in Russia, you're in Berlin, but you may be speaking with voters in Russia. And if you are, what are they telling you?
Well, there is a lot of confusion and a lot of apathy in Russia. People understand that there'll be no change in Russia while the war is raging. You can say that Russian opposition fell victim to geopolitics. It is very hard to organize protest movements when the country is at war, and a war which it proclaims to be an existential war. That's how the Kremlin sees it, and that's how the propaganda is presenting it too. So people hope for change. Their opposition is being supported by many people, especially in urban centers, especially in the two capitals, in Moscow and St. Petersburg. However, there is, I think, an overwhelming understanding that domestic politics will return and opposition politics will return only when the war is over.
Leonid, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
Leonid Rogozin is a freelance Russian journalist who's based outside Russia. We reached him in Berlin. Giraffes are majestic and elegant creatures. Their gait is graceful and long, and they show endless patience grazing on the tops of trees, taking their time to yank out mouthfuls of leaves with their dignified lips and their long, svelte tongues. But giraffes' entry into the world is a little more abrupt, because just as a reminder, giraffes are tall. This week, Chester Zoo in England welcomed a rare Rothschild giraffe calf into the world. They got it all on camera, and its arrival is a big deal for a population that's under significant threat in the wild. Rosie Owen is the giraffe keeper at the Chester Zoo. We reached her in Chester.
Rosie, how is Orla, the mother, feeling? Is she feeling proud of this achievement and what she's brought into the world?
Well, I hope so. It's a big achievement. She's doing very well. It's not her first time calf, okay. But she's had, this will be a seventh actually. So yeah, she's a very experienced mum, and she's doing amazing. She's a very, very good mum, she is.
I am going to ask more about the calf, of course, but I start with Orla, because the pregnancy itself ran 472 days. Labor was 3 hours. She made it look easy in that video I saw, but I don't know that it actually was. Describe for our listeners what they'll see in that video your team managed to capture.
I mean, yeah, she makes it look so easy.
Slides right out.
I doubt it was that easy, bless her. But like I said, she's not the first time. She knows exactly what she's doing. And she's done a very good job bringing that calf here to us.
And how is the calf doing?
Very energetic. I've never known a calf to be this energetic. This is my fifth calf at the zoo, and this one is just got a ball of energy. Always up and about. I mean, Orla's got to just keep an eye on them all the time, basically. She's got to have eyes at the back of her head to keep an eye on them. But yeah, very, very healthy calf, exactly what we were looking for, and a good healthy weight as well. So yeah, all good.
Obviously, the video is edited, but it seemed to jump up and get into action pretty quickly after, you know, they have a long way to fall, obviously, when they're born. So how quickly did happen?
It's a bit of a shock entrance to the world when a giraffe is born. Yeah, so it's about, you know, it's a 6 foot drop when they're born, and like I said, like they hit the ground, and that's when the the sackle burst, and they basically take their first breath. Well, it helps them take their first breath. And a couple of minutes or so, they're just lying still, but Ola pretty soon afterwards comes over and makes sure everything's okay, and we'll start licking them clean and making sure, you know, they're fine. And yeah, it's not long afterwards when they're already trying to stand, basically. It's literally within probably 5-10 minutes they're already up. They're a bit wobbly and unsteady at first, but they soon find their way.
Were you watching it live, or did you see it after the fact?
So no, not live. It happened in the middle of the night on Tuesday. So yeah, it was a lovely surprise to walk into in the morning. I was one of the first people who got to see them. So yeah, very, very nice things come to work to see.
I bet. Yeah. Good news. 472 days. What is a normal pregnancy for a giraffe?
Yeah. So they're usually pregnant for 15 months. And Ola, it's a long, long time. We go in by days just so we can keep track, because they can come a bit early or a bit later. And Ola seems to give birth around the same amount of days. So the last calf she had was 473. So we knew it would be around that time. But it's a long, long time to wait for one.
Couldn't quite break the record, this one, the 472 days. Just shy of the record.
Yeah, just shy.
No name yet, and you don't know the sex yet?
No, not yet. So we'll catch the calf up, basically to be microchipped, and we can check the sex then. Mm-hmm. And then as a team, we'll start thinking of it. We've started bringing some names into, but we obviously can't decide until if we know it's male or female. So, it's an exciting time to come.
And in terms of this particular species, a Rothschild, what is unique about a Rothschild giraffe?
So they are classed as endangered in the wild. There's not many of them left. There's around 2,500 in the wild. So, yeah, and their numbers have been declining. So this birth is very important to help, you know, the conservation of this species. They're a bit different. So unlike the giraffe, how you can tell it's a Rothschild is the spots only come up to about their knee, or what you class as their knee. And then they have like what we call the white socks from the knee down to the hoof, basically. So that's how you can tell it's a Rothschild giraffe. This birth is very important to help the breeding program in captivity, basically.
And will that help, you know, revive the populations in the countries that they're actually from? Kenya, Uganda, Sudan?
These giraffes will never get released into the wild, but it'll help make people aware and educate people on the importance of trying to conserve these giraffes. We work with partners out in Africa as a zoo. We support them and donate money to help. What the work they do out in Africa is to basically help increase the numbers out there.
You mentioned a little bit about what's going to happen next for the baby and its mom, Orla. Yeah. Where's the dad?
Meru, that's his name. He's around. He's seen the calf.
They've met.
And he's had a little sniff of them from over the fence line. But he will not meet them until he'll be the very last individual to meet them, actually. So he gets to meet the little one when we let them outside for the first time. He's a very good dad. He's very nurturing, actually, and quite attentive to them. So by Monday, Tuesday, that's when we're hoping, if the weather's good, to let them outside for the first time, which is a very exciting thing.
It sounds like whatever happens in the herd, it sounds like this one can keep up with it.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. I think we've got our work cut out for us with this one. Yeah.
Well, congratulations and good luck, Rosie.
Oh, thank you very, very much. Thank you.
Rosie Owen is the giraffe keeper at Chester Zoo. We reached her in Chester, England. No one invented singing along with the radio. That happened the first time a DJ played ABBA, or possibly earlier. And Japan took the idea of singing along to recorded music even farther. For years, it had a radio program called Pop Songs Without Lyrics in the morning, so you could sing into a spoon at breakfast before going to work. So Shigeichi Negishi isn't known as the inventor of karaoke because he invented shrieking along to Bohemian Rhapsody. It's because he invented a way for your voice to come out of the speakers along with the music from Bohemian Rhapsody. Mr. Negishi's family just announced that he has died at the age of 100. He was a big fan of the show Pop Songs Without Lyrics. And one day in 1967, after listening to it, he arrived at work at a company that made tape decks and had a brainstorm. He asked a coworker, quote, "Can we hook a microphone up to one of these tape decks so I can hear myself singing over a recording of Pop Songs Without Lyrics?" Unquote. They tried it, and as a singer, he was tone deaf, but as he told an interviewer, quote, "It works. That's all I was thinking. Most of all, it was fun. I knew right away I had discovered something new," unquote. It was new. He called his invention the Sparko Box. It was amazing and portable, plus it had cool lights. But it wasn't a huge success, and getting a patent in Japan back then was a hassle, so he didn't bother, and subsequently he watched as other inventors made their own versions of his machine. Still, his portable karaoke machine was a major breakthrough. Maybe he couldn't carry a tune, but he made it possible for others to.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share two hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Tomorrow will mark 1 year since a three-story building in Old Montreal erupted in flames. 7 people died in that fire. One of them was Dunya Zafar, a 31-year-old woman from Pakistan who was living in Toronto. Ms. Zafar and her childhood friend Sanya Khan decided to take a spontaneous trip and were meant to stay in an Airbnb for just one night. That night, the building caught on fire. The police believe the fire to have been arson, and the criminal investigation continues. Until it concludes, a coroner's inquest remains on pause, and 6 of the 7 victims' families are part of a $22 million class action lawsuit against the city of Montreal and the building owner. Zafar Mahmoud is Dunya Zafar's father. We reached him in Lahore, Pakistan.
Zafar, how will you and your family mark the anniversary of your daughter's death tomorrow?
It's quite hard to think about all those things that Dunya is not with us anymore. We miss her caring attitude. She always talks to us daily, inquired us about our health and other daily routines, and tells her about herself, what she is doing over there. We miss her. She has a twinkle in her eyes. There was sweetness in her voice. And her death, in fact, changed the meaning of life, the meaning of almost like what is happiness, what is laughing, what is life, what is death. It's all intermingled.
So clearly, even though the anniversary is tomorrow, you're living this every day. You're mourning her every day.
In fact, right at this time, I think an hour before, we talked to her for the last time. It was one day before.
What did she tell you?
She told us that tomorrow after in the morning, I will be back to Toronto, but that she never reached there. Slowly and steadily, I realized with the death of the Dunya, we have also died. We have withdrawn from the life. She might have ended, she might have faced agony of few minutes, but we are here. We have to die a bit by bit, a second by second. We don't know how much life we have, but it's all without Dunya, without that. I have two other kids, but she was the eldest one.
How are your other children doing?
they are also like this. Varda used to talk to her. They are of this. They used to talk about their problems with each other. So she has lost a companion. So she they always talk to her and get the guidance what to do, how to celebrate our wedding anniversary, mm-hmm. What to give us on our birthdays. So that thing has gone. The beauty of life has gone.
We know the criminal investigation is underway. It began in August. We know police believe the fire was deliberately set. But what other questions do you want answered?
To me, that is the second part of the whole problem. The first is why they were there. Why my kid were there. They were not supposed to be over there.
What do you
mean?
That
was an illegal listing. Hmm. That was not meant for short-term listing and stay over there. That building was supposed to have other safeguards over there. Each and everything was missing. There was no proper fire exit. That was not properly secured, or that even all the rooms do not have the windows. So whether that was intentional or accidental, they would have faced the same fate, the same. They have to die over there because that was so unsafe. Nothing else, nothing more.
Are police keeping you updated regularly on their investigation? Because I know that in the newspapers here, other parents are upset it's taking so long.
Yeah, we are. Because it's also written in the books that justice delayed is justice denied. And I think some questions lose their essence with so much time. What I want, that is sure, that was illegal. This thing should have done something. That should have been answered. The justice should have been done for that, only that question. It's the next part. Who started the fire? Was that accidental? What was intentional? Mm-hmm. That there was dispute by two or three persons that did that damn thing.
You mentioned she was visiting Montreal. She was set to come back to Toronto. She was going to build a life here.
Yeah, she loves Toronto. She loves Toronto. During these days, when there used to be some sun, or she used to took her book and she cook herself some sandwiches and go outside and sit there and read her books. She loves books. She is always fond of reading something like that.
What did she want from her life here? What did she tell you about her life in Toronto?
In fact, she wanted to be involved with books, and she wanted her dreams to come true. I think that city was providing him maximum opportunity to show her potential to the world. There, nothing stops you from achieving your dreams. In Pakistan, there must be some hiccups or some unforced things which stops you from moving forward. Those are the societies which promote such thing. They promote talent. You can show your worth, what you have. She was there to conquer the world. She wasn't there to die for and due to the fault of somebody else. So she was quite happy. She was quite happy.
What will justice look like for you at the end of this investigation, the coroner's inquest, which is on pause right now, and your lawsuit with the other families?
I think I'm very much have full confidence in their investigation. I'm sure they will find the right person. But when that will happen, it's also hurting. It's hurting us, really. It's almost 365 days, and it might take further 365 days or that, so much so. So I think we are looking forward. It should be solved easily, as early as possible. The justice should be delivered to all the victims.
Zafar, thank you very much for your time. Again, my condolences.
Most welcome. Most welcome.
Zafar Mahmood is the father of the late Dania Zafar. We reached him in Lahore, Pakistan. In February, Jennifer Crumbly was convicted of involuntary manslaughter, 2 years after her 15-year-old son Ethan carried out the deadliest school shooting in Michigan history. It was the first time a parent was held responsible for a school shooting committed by their child in the United States. Last night, Ms. Crumbly's husband, James Crumbly, was also convicted on the same charge of involuntary manslaughter for buying their son the gun and failing to address his mental health needs. Craig Schilling's son, Justin, was one of the four students killed at Oxford High School. Neil spoke with Mr. Schilling the day after Jennifer Crumbly was convicted.
Craig, you woke up today knowing Jennifer Crumbly was convicted of involuntary manslaughter. Did that knowledge make it easier to sleep through the night?
Last night I slept through it very well because it was just an exhausting day. Mm-hmm. Waking up this morning, knowing that she was convicted, it's definitely a load off my chest, a little bit off my mind. But knowing that there's still a lot more to do, it just kind of shifts my focus to the next thing, and it's definitely like a cycle.
Hearing those words yesterday, the guilty verdict, after all that you've been through and all of these months, how did that sit with you to hear it out loud?
Well, there was a pretty broad range of emotions. The tensions were high, when they finally came. Everybody had a deep exhale, and you could hear it. And you can almost feel the energy in the room change, and it was a moment for sure. There's no, happiness or about anything in this situation, so I can't really say that, I'm happy for it. I'm just glad that, the outcome went the way that we were hoping for.
You said after the verdict that it feels like a milestone, this decision. Do you think it sends a message to parents across the United States as well?
Absolutely. I feel that it does get a message across, and the culpability of this type of thing is more broader than just the person who does it. And we're thankful to have the law enforcement and the investigators and the prosecutors that worked tirelessly on the case to make sure that it was dealt with right and that all the evidence was presented in an appropriate way, and they did a great job. And it was a milestone for sure.
From February, that was Neil speaking with Craig Schilling, whose son was killed in the mass shooting at Oxford High School in 2021. Both parents of the 15-year-old shooter have now been convicted of involuntary manslaughter. For weeks, the threat of starvation has been rising in Gaza. Already, at least 23 children have reportedly died of malnutrition. And the United Nations says a quarter of the population is on the brink of famine. But this week, the UN was able to access a new land crossing and deliver much-needed aid to northern Gaza. Israel's defense minister, Yoav Gallant, also visited the north, calling aid a central issue. And yesterday, an official with the ministry said Israel plans to, quote, flood northern Gaza with aid. Jamie McGoldrick is the United Nations Humanitarian Coordinator for the Occupied Palestinian Territory. We reached him in Jerusalem.
Jamie, we know the need is certainly immense, to say the least, but what does the opening of this new land crossing signal to you?
Well, the land crossing, the one to the east side, which is the military road, they call it Route 96, is really going to be very helpful because two reasons. One, because there's no congestion or security problems on that road, which we face inside Gaza itself. It's an external road. And because of that, then the second part is it allows us to get a very fast move and very fast supply and continual supply into north part of Gaza, which hasn't seen any real substantive supplies of any kind for the last couple of months.
As our listeners just heard in the introduction, a spokesperson for Israel's Defense Forces told reporters Israel plans to, quote, flood northern Gaza with aid. When you hear that, do you believe him?
Yeah, I do believe that that's what they want to do, and that's something we're the ones that have been using that phrase, flood and swamp the north and the whole of Gaza, because that's the only way we're going to take away, obviously, the starvation and hunger that's facing millions of people inside. But it's also the fact that by doing that, you take away the desperation, and the desperation which is causing the insecurity in many places. But doing that's not going to be easy, because there's only one supply route right now inside, which is through Kerem Shalom and into Rafah, which is 250 trucks a day. We need 500 trucks a day to satisfy that need.
Why do you think Israel is making this apparent shift now?
I think it's a couple of things. I think it's because they know themselves there hasn't been much in the way of goods have gone into the north for any significant period of time. And secondly, they've seen the reports that are coming out from hospitals in the north where children are coming to those hospitals emaciated and dehydrated. And I heard the report from the Shifa Hospital that 30 children had died recently from links to nutritional and food security issues.
In terms of the desperation and the difficulties, we've seen that the release of aid can be deadly in some cases. There was a case just yesterday. Gaza's health ministry says at least 20 people were killed and more than 150 people were wounded as they were waiting for food. They blame the Israelis, saying it was Israeli shelling that caused those deaths. Israel refutes that, saying there were armed Palestinians there. But on the wider issue, what is happening in those moments?
Well, I think what's happening is that the desperation is driving people to come down closer to the military road where the Israelis have their checkpoints. And these are the same roads which we try to use to feed and supply to the north. So people stop the trucks when they take the contents off the back. What we need to do is by swamping the area, by flooding the area with food through all the different avenues we have, and then to try and get food into those areas to prevent those young people coming down in search of a food and to stop them coming down and stopping the trucks.
You just returned from Gaza, as I understand it. You've been there repeatedly since you were appointed. How have you seen things shift since December?
Well, I mean, clearly because of the ongoing hostilities and more displacement, what's happening now is you see because there's a threat of a military incursion into Rafah in the southern part, people are now moving away from the actual city centre, Rafah itself, and moving to the coast to these areas, Al-Mawasi and other areas, and setting up camps there. And there's been an increase in growth of these unplanned camps along that beachfront. So that's one of the things you see. The other thing you see is the fact that just that people are getting more and more sort of affected by the fact that the desperation is there and that they're absorbing the fact that maybe this is it for a long time. Some people have been displaced 4 or 5 times. They refuse to move again. Some people are stuck in a situation of real squalor and, you know, overcrowded, very unsanitary conditions. And the health issues are starting to arrive. So these are the things that are there and they're getting worse because our ability to address them has been limited by the amount of material we can bring in, which is the 250 trucks a day.
On the issue of how much is getting in, we've spoken to many guests since October 7th, and many of them have accused Israel of blocking the flow of sufficient aid into Gaza. Yesterday, you may have heard Israeli Colonel Elad Goren saying, quote, the issue isn't the scanning and delivery of aid to Gaza. It's how much the UN can collect and deliver within Gaza, unquote. Is he wrong?
Well, they always say that. That's always their excuse. I mean, for example, today is Friday. They only work half a day. Tomorrow is Shabbat, so Saturday they don't work. And then other days, they've only got the scanning capacity for 250 trucks a day. So on a good day, we get 250 trucks. But as they leave Kerem Shalom from there, they have to come into where we are on the Gaza side. We have to unload those trucks and load trucks again. So it's not a matter, if we could bring the trucks from Kerem Shalom and go straight out and into Rafah and supply then, we could do it quite effectively. If they worked longer hours in that side, if they had more scanning capacity in that side, we could get far more trucks through in the day. So all of those factors are not our issues. They've been imposed by Israel.
Israel also says it needs to conduct strict inspections of supplies entering Gaza, saying that they could end up in the hands of Hamas. Does Israel have have the right or even the responsibility to do that from where you stand?
No, I think they should. I mean, if goods are coming in from there and they think they're suspicious items, they have to inspect them and scan them. And no one's contesting that. That's their right, and that's what they should do. But they should also equally know that the number of tricks they have are limited by the scanning capacity they have, which is 250. We've now five or six months into this crisis. Why have they not brought in more scanning capacity? If you go to Ashdod in the north, which is a very large, modern, well-equipped port, we could bring goods in from there quite easily into Gaza. And equally, in Jordan, we have a pipeline there, and Israel has scanning capacity there, but we're only getting 50 trucks a day. So there's ways of increasing the capacity of scanning and not just using Kerem Shalom. And we've been pushing for that for some time.
At the very same time, Israel is endorsing plans to improve aid delivery. As we've been discussing, it is continuing to endorse plans to invade Rafah. And just today, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he has approved plans for a military operation that includes the evacuation of civilians. And what do you make of what he's saying and what's happening on both of these fronts?
Well, I'd say like on the actual invasion, the incursion into Rafah, people fear that already and have started moving. But what I'd also say is that we're not ready to accommodate anything of that kind. We're right now struggling to address the needs of people who are stable, who are static. If a large number of those people who are currently displaced were moved yet again because of military incursion, we don't have the pre-planning or the pre-positioning of material like tents and blankets and foodstuffs and medical supply and water to address that move. We're facing a catastrophic situation right now. If we were to put a catastrophe on top of a catastrophe, I'm not sure what the result is. It will be so tragic for all of those people who will be caught up in an incursion of military in street battles, and then for people then to be forced to run from those areas and not able to carry what they've got to move to somewhere else. We've got nothing to give them. You can't describe that.
Jamie, thank you.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Jamie McGoldrick is the UN's humanitarian coordinator for the occupied Palestinian territory. He's in Jerusalem. Erica Weeb is not new to the spotlight, but the Canadian wrestling champion is new to her current role. After years on the mat, she has transitioned to commentating on the sport she once dominated. Ms. Weeb won gold at the Rio Olympics in 2016 and is a two-time Commonwealth Games champion. But as she explained in a conversation about her newly announced retirement, she was not an overnight success.
It's funny because when I started wrestling in grade 9, women's wrestling was not an Olympic sport. So it was never really on my radar. But then quickly I was like, okay, there's this opportunity. And I, you know, was having a lot of success and loving it really early on. So in grade 12 in my high school yearbook, I wrote, "Watch for me in 2012. I was a pretty audacious, I guess, grade 12 student. And then I moved across the country to start wrestling at the UFC. And there was like a lot of struggles, lots of challenges. I didn't make the London Olympic teams. Mm-hmm. In fact, I didn't actually make the varsity team my first year. I went to Calgary to wrestle with women that were better, stronger, faster than me, have the best coaches, the best facilities in the country. It was a really big challenging start to me. But in 2013, I made my first senior national team, and I actually beat the reigning Olympic champion in a competition in the summer in Poland. And I thought, okay, whoa, here I can, it was a moment for me where I was like, I can really be something in this sport. And coming back from the London Games and having some of those early wins in 2013 really set the table for the success that I was, you know, on the way to have in 2016. But, you know, I feel so confident in knowing that the next chapter is exciting and is ahead of me. And I feel like I'm going to accomplish more off the mats than I ever would have on the mat.
Canadian wrestling champion Erica Weeb talking about her retirement with the CBC's Rebecca Zandbergen. You've been listening to the As It Happens podcast. Our show can be heard Monday to Friday on CBC Radio 1 after Your World Tonight.
And you can, of course, also listen to our show online at cbc.ca/AIH or on the CBC Listen app, or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.